folks, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of Talk to Me in the Car, a podcast about all things teaching related and education inspired that I literally record right here in my vehicle on my drive back from work as a high school instructional coach just outside of Washington, D.C. Bad traffic is a good time for podcasting because there's not much else going on, so it's a nice bumper-to-bumper brain dumper like that. New episodes drop every Monday. This week, I'm going to drop an idea that is still very much in, like, the middle of development, right? Normally when you hear, like, presentations, podcasts, you go to conferences, events, read books, blogs, it's, like, the best version that made it to public. This isn't that. This is the, you know, warts and all version of what we're looking at. Under the hood, at a lesson that I'm currently developing and kind of walking through the methodology, the backwards design, about how that works. Because last week we talked about project-based learning and project-based assessment, and today I wanted to walk us through maybe a closer look at what that could look like in one sample classroom. More on that in a second, but first things first. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to like or subscribe. Leave a comment. It does help people find the show. We record here in the car every Monday, and new episodes drop on Spotify and Apple Music and all those fun stuff. So if you give a thumbs up, it helps other people find the show. Thank you. If you want to talk to me, hit me up on Twitter. I'm at MeehanEDU. That's Meehan like my last name, and EDU like teaching. Because I love talking about teaching, and I want to get better at it each and every day. We don't do this job to get paid, we do this job to make a difference. And I think that talking about making a difference to people who are trying to make a difference push us to do better, right? Iron sharpens iron, steel sharpens steel. And I very much appreciate people who take the time to chime in, so thank you. At MeehanEDU on Twitter. I will talk to you always about this stuff. And I hang out on the internet. I have a website, emc2learning.com. Which is all about a new book that Michael Matera and I wrote together. It's called Fully Engaged, Playful Pedagogy for Real Results. We have a membership community, we have forums, we have discussion boards, we have templates, we have resources, we have videos. It doesn't suck. Check it out, emc2learning.com. We have a free membership tier, which is called our Tinker Teachers. Love to have you join us. Or if you wanted to support the movement, the community we're building, new episodes, new opportunities, new items, new resources are dropping all the time. That we have a community of what they call engagement engineers all over the planet, and I gotta tell you, it is, for my money, the best PD I've ever found is to be around people who want to do it right. So thank you for hanging out there at emc2learning.com. But today I want to talk about something that's totally under development. Here's my plan. I'm going to do a project. Oh my goodness gracious. And that project is going to be well, I'm not sure. The beauty about it, first a few quotes, I like to lean in on good quotes from smart people. It helps me feel like I'm not alone in what I'm about to do, no matter how crazy it is. Dwight D. Eisenhower, famous general turned United States statesman, president, Eisenhower said famously, quote, "He finds planning to be essential, but plans to be useless." I think that's great when I think about, you know, what a general does and what a statesman, a diplomat does, right? You need to know in advance. You have to have a plan of attack. But when you get there, you have to be flexible. Everything on your feet. You have to be able to adapt and, as REO Speedwagon would say, roll with the changes. I think it was Mike Tyson who said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth or punched in the face. And I think that there's something very true about that, about teaching, right? We have our lesson plans, but then we have our lessons in practice. And as we hit the real live people, well, they hit us right back sometimes. So it can knock us for a loop and send us flying. We have to be able to read the room and adapt and overcome, right? Stick and move. I think that boxing metaphor is not a bad one. Ultimately, our goal is to knock down those learning objectives, to make our students feel like they are the champions in their own learning, to get them to see that they are stronger today, mentally more adroit, more aware, more like, you know, on their feet, and I guess on their toes about whatever we're trying to cover, and to put them in a position where they trust their instincts so that they don't just throw the jab, 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 jab all the time, but they learn how to throw a few right hooks. They learn how to throw a few uppercuts, a few knockout punches. Their goal is to stick and move, to make their way around the metaphorical boxing ring so they could show off all of the different skills they learn and trust their instincts and flex their muscles at the right time. And what a good planning does before the test or before the lesson is it gives us myriad ways to equip our students with tools, resources, skills to help them feel, you know, ready to go for whatever that fight will bring. Whether that fight is the test or the standardized exam at the end of the year, the big project, or just when they leave the classroom, you know, what skills you hope that they transfer long after you've coached them up and said, ding, 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 the bells are ringing. Like, you send them out to go, and you hope to goodness that everything you have trained them up for is able to translate when they, you know, enter those title fights, metaphorically speaking. Okay, enough about the metaphor. But for my class, I work in an 11th grade classroom for English. My students are just wrapping up a unit on short fiction, literary fiction. Now, for a year and a half, they've done a lot of teaching themselves at home. Yes, they are reading, but I don't know that they were reading literature as literature was intended to be reading. Read. Literature, especially literary fiction, is designed to be like slow and savored. It's often not very plot-driven. It's driven by character. So there's nuance, there's wrinkle, there's depth, right? There's not much of a forward plot or action, especially in short stories. It's very simple, 3 pages, 5 pages. There's not like, plot twist, you never saw that coming, and then a meteor hit them, or a dragon came out of nowhere. That's not the kind of books we read in English class, at least not typically. Instead, we really focus on like the author's craft. What is the writer, you know, the storyteller, trying to get us to feel or think? What is the subtext? What is all that stuff under the tip of the iceberg? And as we read short works of fiction by people like Ernest Hemingway, for example, famously does so much with so little, gives us just the tip, and asks us to dig and plumb into those depths. What's really going on underneath the surface as characters are expressing very deep emotions with very few words? If a guy and a girl are having lunch, and the guy says, "How are you?" And she's like, "I'm fine." And then she repeats, "I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine," like 3 or 4 times. We are probably to understand that she is not fine. We have to figure out why she's not fine. And what great fiction does is it gives us all of the clues to get to that without forcing us to you know, kind of run hoops or run loops around it to invent backstories. There's a realm of appropriate answers inside of any given text. So for my first unit of the year, my students came into the school year having read a work of literature and a work of fiction. I guess the literature is Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy. It is a true story of his life as an attorney on death row in Alabama, trying to become the first person to successfully argue for the release of a person of color on Alabama's death row. It's a powerful story. It's very harrowing. It's very strong. It's very brave. It's very strident. And it is packed with all sorts of subtext about the death penalty. And as we work in a Catholic school about issues of social justice and the dignity of every human person, we lean pretty heavily on that in the school in which I teach. But we use that work of, I guess, literary nonfiction to pair with timeless work of literary fiction in the canon. We talked about Harper Lee's famous book, To Kill a Mockingbird. Most everyone in their life has been exposed to or encountered the story of Atticus Finch fighting for rights, the wrongly accused Tom Robinson in the fictional town of Macon, Alabama. So this is a nice paired text to pair fact and fiction together early in the year, so students can see what that famous TED Talk calls the danger of a single story. That it's not just a white savior who comes, swoops in, and then saves racism, right, or stops, you know, the world from being racist. Rather, it is the work that we do on a day-to-day basis to affirm and protect the dignity of every human person, both in works of fiction, to raise awareness of the fact, and in real life, outside of the work of fiction. So that's sort of the tenor of the unit, or the idea of the year. I think the TED Talk, her name is Chimamanda Adichie, and it's so good, the idea of this danger of a single story. It's not that any single story is untrue, per se. It's that it's incomplete. And if we start the story with Atticus Finch, we fail to recognize the story of Tom Robinson that exists before that, or the story of racial oppression that exists long before fictional characters are added to the world of solving that problem, right? Real-life Harper Lee, it is, I mean, reasonably assured, was writing that book so as she could raise awareness of the plight of persons who were experiencing injustice, particularly racial injustice, in the time of her book's composition. It is likely that she knew real-life people and real-life stories of racism, oppression, violence that had nothing to do with fictional characters like Scout Finch or Atticus Finch, Tom Robinson, Boo Radley. And in writing her book, she's trying to raise broader awareness of some deeper, real issues underneath the surface. Again, the whole story is not what is in her book. You know, the single story is that of the fictional Finch family, but the real-life story is much broader. It's much more, I guess, fully realized. And that's not to say that Harper Lee's done a bad job, but the book's great. it certainly holds up, you know, 20, 30, 50 years after it has been written as, yep, this book still is very accessible and a way to help people understand how people of a certain time and place were starting to see problems with the society in which they live. And because Harper Lee herself is writing from the perspective of a young girl coming of age in this time of a, you know, racially tense southern environment, through the character's eyes, we start to see, hey, there's something wrong with this. And I'm learning just enough through this character that I'm realizing there's something wrong, but I don't yet have the words to understand what or why it is. And we push, and that's good. So what Harper Lee does so well is introduces us to a world where racism is real. And for many of her audience, primarily white readers, right, they then come to see the world of, you know, racism and bigotry. Unfortunately, the challenge here is that through Harper Lee's story, we see this through, like, the sanitized, conveniently accessible view of white characters. So white characters are realizing that the world was wrong. If you were a person of color living in that same space in that same time, it is likely you would not need a fictional story about white people to introduce you to that same piece. We don't need to have fake stories about real people in these spaces. Real people could tell real stories in these spaces, and unfortunately, I guess that's where the Adichie TED Talk really goes with it. Telling own voices, stories of people who have lived it, who have been there, who are, you know, every day this is their lived truth, or their lived reality, their lived experience. And the challenge is, how do we bring those voices in who have so often or for so long been marginalized or forgotten? It's a good problem to have. I promise I'm going somewhere with this. You're like, okay, but what's the project in your class? Well, this is the point. The whole unit was designed to pair fact and fiction, real-life stories and real-life plights and real-life traumas and real-life tragedies with these works of short literature that are designed to raise awareness of some really hard issues. We read a series of short stories. I'll just rattle a few of them off right now. We read a story called Currents by Hannah Voskuhl, and it's about a drowning at the beach one day. And the whole story is very, very short, but it's told in reverse. And it's about a man who self-medicates by drinking single malt whiskey at the beginning of the story. We come to find out, like, eight paragraphs later, that he has witnessed a drowning, and he's drinking because he doesn't know what to do. And that whole story is like a big old flashback. It's like, oh man, how do you get out of that? And then maybe you can't. And so you just drink it away, right? You self-medicate. We read In the Cemetery Where Al Jolson is Buried, which is an awesome short meditation. It's humorous. It's funny. It's sad. It's about two friends who are in a cancer ward, one visiting the other. She has terminal cancer. And about the jokes and like the nothing burgers of conversation that we share in the time that we have with people that we love before, ultimately, you know, one of these characters succumbs to this disease that has afflicted her from before the story began. And it's a very hard story. It's a very fictional story. But it's a very true fact that we all, you know, at one point or another have to grieve and deal with people who are grieving. And trying to find the right words to say what you can say. We read The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, which is about a woman who is suffering from postpartum depression. Finds herself committed to a rest cure, much like an asylum, in the late 1800s. And that does not go well, in case you're curious, for anybody who in real life or in fiction find themselves locked away from other people to try to grapple with their own mental health issues. We know the trouble with that. And the problems it causes are very real, played out in the scene, in the story, in a very very harrowing big reveal at the end that I won't give away. It's very, very good, I promise. We also had a chance to read a book, or an excerpt from a short piece called The Memory Piece of the Creech People by Justin Theroux's uncle. Yeah, that guy who, like, dated Jennifer Aniston forever. I think his name's Paul Theroux. He's a travel writer. And in The Memory Piece of the Creech People, Theroux, who is a travel journalist, tells the story of a fictional tribe of people who appoint one person to be their receiver of memories and their teller of stories. Only there's one big secret they don't tell him, is that at his 30th birthday, they're going to kill him. And then the whole cycle will reset itself again. So it's about the idea of loss of choice, again, loss of volition. We saw that again with The Yellow Wallpaper. We saw that with Just Mercy, right? Stories where people have decisions made for them and they don't have autonomy over their mind or their body or their spirit. We got a chance to read two great stories by African-American authors, female authors of the 1970s. We read a great story called The Lesson by Toni Kate Bambara, which is about redistribution of wealth and telling a few students of color in a, you know, kind of a passing story that it's the summertime and they head to New York City. They visit F.A.O. Schwartz and they learn about the cost of things. And it doesn't feel like it's a real lesson, it doesn't feel like it's real school, but there's some deep-seated lessons in there that this teacher character, Miss Moore, is helping students trip over the truth and causing occasions for them to say, hey, wait a minute, these people spend more on toys than I spend, than my parents will make all year. Is that right? You know, and are we okay with that? Without coming out and being so preachy, Moore says in her, not Miss Moore, I'm sorry, Barbara says in her own writing, the goal of a writer is to make the language of a revolution irresistible. And that's what she does. In writing this story, she makes us want to fight for redistribution of wealth and a more equitable avenue for success for people regardless of their race or their color or their creed. We also had a chance to read a short piece called Sweet Potato Pie by a woman named Eugenia Collier. Both of those stories written in the 1970s. And Collier's piece is about code switching and about coming home to our ancestral home and feeling like we're not allowed to belong. Have you ever read the short story by Shel Silverstein, Lafcadio, the Lion Who Shot Back? It's about a lion who learns how to shoot a gun and becomes like this circus attraction, but doesn't fit in with the lions because it's shooting a gun. It never really quite fits in with the men because it's always seen as less than or othered. Then there's this beautiful juxtaposition here in this story, Sweet Potato Pie, about the things we have to compromise about ourselves in order to get ahead, our culture, our food, our families. And all these stories kind of fit together in this cool, I guess, myriad collection of this big old question of the American dream. So the unit begins with a question of fact and fiction, presents then a series of 8, 9, 10, 15 different stories, all of which are dealing with this juxtaposition of fact and fiction. We had a chance to read Ernest Hemingway's Hills Like White Elephants, where a male character is pressuring a female character into getting, quote, a very simple operation that it's nothing, when it's clear that she doesn't feel comfortable getting that operation. So there's a lot of issues at play here that have contemporary relevance about, you know, the idea of a Me Too movement, the idea of the bodily autonomy, the idea of human dignity or social justice, the idea of people being pushed around or bullied around because of their age, because of their race, because of their gender, because of their sexual orientation. And if the whole unit was designed to give this very real depth to these very fake stories, I wanted to do my final product or final project on the unit in the same vein. So here's what I'm in the middle of, and this is where I wait till the 15-minute mark of a podcast to get to it, because I think it's important to understand where we came from before we get to where we're going. The essential skills is to understand how real and fake work together, how authors use fiction to tell fact, to raise awareness of very real, very hard, very difficult, or very important issues. So I want my students to break into teams and plan a charity event inspired by any one of the works that we have read together thus far. Now, what that charity event will look like, I don't know. What that charity event will sound like and who it will appeal to, that's entirely up to them. How long the charity event will be, what the monies will go to, again, that's entirely up to our students. But I think the beauty of this activity, while I'm still sort of kicking it around and coming through the finer points of it, I don't want my students to feel like they are the saviors. I don't want them to feel like, you know, it is their job to feel guilty or ashamed having read these stories. But rather, if an author writes a fake story to bring real awareness to an issue that is deeply troubling to them, right? Like the pearl and the oyster, or, you know, like the shell at the bottom of the ocean. How do we get that grain of sand to stick with us, to trouble us, and make us want to make something beautiful? I think those authors would be, you know, quite proud to find out that their work is inspiring people to do, you know, life-imitating art, right? Things that are good for the betterment of these issues that they're raising awareness for. And if the charities themselves do not yet exist, hypothetically, well then, why couldn't we create one? But doing it so in a respectful way, so we're not swooping in as the savior, as the person whose own voice is the only one that matters. Rather, we're echoing the Adichie speech and the idea of the danger of a single story, trying to bring light and awareness to what someone is struggling with, what someone's told, lived reality has got them to, and say, hey, this is where I currently have to leave off because either I have passed on or, you know, I've done all I can do. But I give the ball to the next person. I say, can you run with it? Can you do something with this? Can you pass this forward? Can we do something to change the world in a positive way? So if you read the lesson and were troubled by it and were struck by it, you know, how would that story talk to the contemporary story of the Black Lives Matter movement? And not because of a political cause, right? Capital B, BLM, Black Lives Matter, political cause, where the filings go in a certain financial direction to support certain political affiliations. No, like, the lives of black people matter, period, full stop. Should not be a political issue. That should be a matter of human dignity. And if this author was fighting for the autonomy and the respect and, you know, the dignity of people of color, well then, how could we give a charity event that would not just be, you know, back to Atticus Finch, the white savior who swoops in and fixes the black man's burden, or the white man's burden, I guess, to use Rudyard Kipling's language. But how do we then empower our society to make authentic changes for redistribution of wealth, for awareness of own voices, for, like, the dangers of single stories, for the problems with cultural assimilation or cultural appropriation? All of these things are really powerful, and they add new light and new depth to the stories that we've kind of studied. So, drawing inspiration from these stories, I don't know what it's going to look like. Maybe you're going to run, you know, a charity race, and all those proceeds would benefit whatever the cause was. But if you're going to run a race, you should tell me what made you pick a race, because if the story itself had nothing to do with athletic ability, maybe a race is not the best way to go about it. Maybe you want to plan a big gala or a charity ball, but if the characters in the story were poor, how could a gala help people who are poor if the people who go to a gala are typically people who are very, very wealthy? If you want to have own voices represented inside of that, this is a very nuanced, a very, like, critical thinking element. I love the idea of layering in any sort of project that I'll create in my classrooms. The five C's, that the Virginia State Standards, they talk about the Virginia profile of a graduate. They talk about creativity and communication, collaboration, and critical thinking. But they layer in this fifth one, which I love, which is about citizenship. Like, what are we doing to become responsible citizens of the world? Where we educate the whole child, to use ASCD's language, to make them more worldly, more aware, more attuned, more empathetic, more kind, more compassionate, and more socially driven to fix things in their society that are inherently unjust. That is not just how we change the game, it's how we change the world. I love it. I think it's a really cool project. Just like I said, I have to finesse it. I would love to hear your thoughts about it. But to use a work of fiction as a springboard for a real life fact, how do we make the world a better place? And what about what we've read has inspired us to want to do that? And if we read a story about mental health or mental illness, mental, you know, distress or mental duress, how do we normalize conversations about seeking help, seeking assistance, seeking support, providing resources that help people who would otherwise be marginalized, bullied, blamed, shamed, or forgotten, to say, hey, this American dream applies to everybody, and you have every right to pursue it in whatever way makes most sense to you. So how do we liberate people? How do we empower people? How do we change the game entirely to get those people back in it? Because it's not experience if you can't bring other people along with it. And I hope through the project, which again is still figuring it out, how it's going to work, my students will come to see new life, new relevance, new joy, and new excitement in the works that they've studied, while also building towards those, like I said, 21st century college career-ready skills where they're becoming, you know, more mindful, more worldly, more aware, more balanced, more equitable, more informed, and then ultimately that makes a better game for everybody. Anyways, that's a thought for today. Would love to hear your thoughts. Hit me up on Twitter, at mehenedu. Let's hang out on the internet, at emctlearning. And there's the blinker. That means I'm at the bridge. I'll see you guys later. Be safe, be well, be vaxxed, and I'll see you next week. Thanks.